This is Audible.
This is a Brilliance audio production. Brilliance Audio and Amazon Publishing are proud to present this Amazon Classics audiobook. After the conclusion of this production, keep listening for an exclusive preview of another Amazon Classics title.
The Arabian Nights by Andrew Lang, performed by Neil Shah. Preface. The stories in the fairy books have generally been such as old women in country places tell to their grandchildren. Nobody knows how old they are, or who told them first. The children of Ham, Shem, and Japheth may have listened to them in the Ark, on wet days. Hector's little boy may have heard them in Troy Town, for it is certain that Homer knew them, and that some of them were written down in Egypt about the time of Moses. People in different countries tell them differently, but they are always the same stories, really, whether among little Zulus at the Cape or little Eskimo near the North Pole. The changes are only in matters of manners and customs, such as wearing clothes or not, meeting lions who talk in the warm countries or talking bears in the cold countries. There are plenty of kings and queens in the fairy tales just because long ago there were plenty of kings in the country. A gentleman who would be a squire now was a kind of king in Scotland in very old times, and the same in other places. These old stories, never forgotten, were taken down in writing in different ages, but mostly in this century, in all sorts of languages. These ancient stories are the contents of the fairy books. Now, the Arabian Nights, some of which, but not nearly all, are given in this volume, are only fairy tales of the East. The people of Asia, Arabia, and Persia told them in their own way, not for children, but for grown-up people. There were no novels then, nor any printed books, of course. But there were people whose profession it was to amuse men and women by telling tales. They dressed the fairy stories up, and made the characters good Mohammedans, living in Baghdad or India. The events were often supposed to happen in the reign of the great caliph, or ruler of the faithful, Harun al-Rashid, who lived in Baghdad in 786 through 808 AD. The vizier who accompanies the caliph was also a real person of the great family of the Barmecides. He was put to death by the caliph in a very cruel way. Nobody ever knew why. The stories must have been told in their present shape a good long while after the caliph died, when nobody knew very exactly what had really happened. At last, some storyteller thought of writing down the tales and fixing them into a kind of framework, as if they had all been narrated to a cruel sultan by his wife. Probably the tales were written down about the time when Edward I was fighting Robert Bruce, but changes were made in them at different dates, and a great deal that is very dull and stupid was put in, and plenty of verses. Neither the verses nor the dull pieces are given in this book. People in France and England knew almost nothing about the Arabian Nights till the reigns of Queen Anne and George I, when they were translated into French by Monsieur Galland. Grown-up people were then very fond of fairy tales, and they thought these Arab stories the best that they had ever read. They were delighted with ghouls, who lived among the tombs, and genii, who seemed to be a kind of ogres, and with princesses who work magic spells, and with peris, who are Arab fairies. Sindbad had adventures which perhaps came out of the Odyssey of Homer. In fact, all the East had contributed its wonders and sent them to Europe in one parcel. Young men once made a noise at Monsieur Galland's window in the dead of night, and asked him to tell them one of his marvelous tales. Nobody talked of anything but dervishes and viziers, rocks and piris. The stories were translated from French into all languages, and only Bishop Atterbury complained that the tales were not likely to be true, and had no moral. The bishop was presently banished for being on the side of Prince Charlie's father, and had leisure to repent of being so solemn. In this book, the Arabian Nights are translated from the French version of Monsieur Galland, who dropped out the poetry and a great deal of what the Arabian authors thought funny, though it seems wearisome to us. In this book, the stories are shortened here and there, and omissions are made of pieces only suitable for Arabs and old gentlemen. The translations are by the writers of the tales in the fairy books, and the pictures are by Mr. Ford. I can remember reading the Arabian Nights when I was 6 years old, in dirty, yellow, old volumes of small type with no pictures, and I hope children who listen to them with Mr. Ford's pictures will be as happy as I was then in the company of Aladdin and Sindbad the Sailor. The Arabian Nights. In the chronicles of the ancient dynasty of the Sassanidae, who reigned for about 400 years, from Persia to the borders of China, beyond the great river Ganges itself, we read the praises of one of the kings of this race, who was said to be the best monarch of his time. His subjects loved him, and his neighbors feared him, and when he died he left his kingdom in a more prosperous and powerful condition than any king had done before him. The two sons who survived him loved each other tenderly, and it was a real grief to the elder, Shahriyar, that the laws of the empire forbade him to share his dominions with his brother Shahzeman. Indeed, after 10 years, during which this state of things had not ceased to trouble him, Shahriyar cut off the country of Great Tartary from the Persian Empire and made his brother king. Now the Sultan Shahriyar had a wife whom he loved more than all the world, and his greatest happiness was to surround her with splendor, and to give her the finest dresses and the most beautiful jewels. It was therefore with the deepest shame and sorrow that he accidentally discovered, after several years, that she had deceived him completely, and her whole conduct turned out to have been so bad that he felt himself obliged to carry out the law of the land and order the Grand Vizier to put her to death. The blow was so heavy that his mind almost gave way, and he declared that he was quite sure that at bottom all women were as wicked as the Sultana, if you could only find them out, and that the fewer the world contained, the better. So every evening he married a fresh wife, and had her strangled the following morning before the Grand Vizier, whose duty it was to provide these unhappy brides for the Sultan. The poor man fulfilled his task with reluctance, but there was no escape, and every day saw a girl married and a wife dead. This behavior caused the greatest horror in the town, where nothing was heard but cries and lamentations. In one house was a father weeping for the loss of his daughter, in another perhaps a mother trembling for the fate of her child, and instead of the blessings that had formerly been heaped on the Sultan's head, the air was now full of curses. The Grand Vizier himself was the father of two daughters, of whom the elder was called Scheherazade, and the younger Dinarzade. Dinarzade had no particular gifts to distinguish her from other girls, but her sister was clever and courageous in the highest degree. Her father had given her the best masters in philosophy, medicine, history, and the fine arts, and besides all this, her beauty excelled that of any girl in the kingdom of Persia. One day, when the Grand Vizier was talking to his eldest daughter, who was his delight and pride, Scheherazade said to him, "Father, I have a favor to ask of you. Will you grant it to me?"
"I can refuse you nothing," replied he. "That is just and reasonable."
"Then listen," said Scheherazade. "I am determined to stop this barbarous practice of the Sultan's, and to deliver the girls and mothers from the awful fate that hangs over them."
"It would be an excellent thing to do," returned the Grand Vizier. "But how do you propose to accomplish it?"
"My father," answered Scheherazade, "it is you who have to provide the Sultan daily with a fresh wife, and I implore you, by all the affection you bear me, to allow the honor to fall upon me."
"Have you lost your senses?" cried the Grand Vizier, starting back in horror.
What has put such a thing into your head? You ought to know by this time what it means to be the Sultan's bride.
Yes, my father. I know it well, replied she. And I am not afraid to think of it. If I fail, my death will be a glorious one. And if I succeed, I shall have done a great service to my country.
It is of no use, said the Grand Vizier. I shall never consent. If the Sultan was to order me to plunge a dagger in your heart, I should have to obey. What a task for a father! Ah, if you do not fear death, fear at any rate the anguish you would cause me.
Once again, my father, said Scheherazade, will you grant me what I ask?
What? Are you still so obstinate?
Exclaimed the Grand Vizier.
Why are you so resolved upon your own ruin?
But the maiden absolutely refused to attend to her father's words, and at length, in despair, the Grand Vizier was obliged to give way, and went sadly to the palace to tell the Sultan that the following evening he would bring him Scheherazade. The Sultan received this news with the greatest astonishment.
How have you made up your mind?
He asked.
To sacrifice your own daughter to me?
Sire, answered the Grand Vizier, it is her own wish. Even the sad fate that awaits her could not hold her back.
Let there be no mistake, Vizier, said the Sultan. Remember, you will have to take her life yourself. If you refuse, I swear that your head shall pay forfeit.
Sire, returned the Vizier, whatever the cost, I will obey you. Though a father, I am also your subject.
So the Sultan told the Grand Vizier he might bring his daughter as soon as he liked. The Vizier took back this news to Scheherazade, who received it as if it had been the most pleasant thing in the world. She thanked her father warmly for yielding to her wishes, and, seeing him still bowed down with grief, told him that she hoped he would never repent having allowed her to marry the Sultan. Then she went to prepare herself for the marriage, and begged that her sister Dinarzade should be sent for to speak to her. When they were alone, Scheherazade addressed her thus.
My dear sister, I want your help in a very important affair. My father is going to take me to the palace to celebrate my marriage with the Sultan. When His Highness receives me, I shall beg him, as a last favor, to let you sleep in our chamber so that I may have your company during the last night I am alive. If, as I hope, he grants me my wish, be sure that you wake me an hour before the dawn and speak to me in these words. My sister, if you are not asleep, I beg you, before the sun rises, to tell me one of your charming stories. Then I shall begin, and I hope by this means to deliver the people from the terror that reigns over them.
Dinarzade replied that she would do with pleasure what her sister wished. When the usual hour arrived, the Grand Vizier conducted Scheherazade to the palace and left her alone with the Sultan, who bade her raise her veil and was amazed at her beauty. But seeing her eyes full of tears, he asked what was the matter.
Sire, replied Scheherazade, I have a sister who loves me as tenderly as I love her. Grant me the favor of allowing her to sleep this night in the same room, as it is the last we shall be together.
Shahryar consented to Scheherazade's petition, and Dinarzade was sent for. An hour before daybreak, Dinarzade awoke and exclaimed, as she had promised,
My dear sister, if you are not asleep, tell me, I pray you, before the sun rises, one of your charming stories. It is the last time that I shall have the pleasure of hearing you.
Scheherazade did not answer her sister, but turned to the Sultan.
Will your highness permit me to do as my sister asks?
She said.
Willingly,
he answered. So Scheherazade began. The Story of the Merchant and the Genius.
Sire, there was once upon a time a merchant who possessed great wealth in land and merchandise, as well as in ready money. He was obliged from time to time to take journeys to arrange his affairs. One day, having to go a long way from home, he mounted his horse, taking with him a small wallet, in which he had put a few biscuits and dates, because he had to pass through the desert, where no food was to be got. He arrived without any mishap, and, having finished his business, set out on his return. On the fourth day of his journey, the heat of the sun being very great, he turned out of his road to rest under some trees. He found at the foot of a large walnut tree a fountain of clear and running water. He dismounted, fastened his horse to a branch of the tree, and sat by the fountain after having taken from his wallet some of his dates and biscuits. When he had finished this frugal meal, he washed his face and hands in the fountain. When he was thus employed, he saw an enormous genius, white with rage, coming towards him with a scimitar in his hand.
"Arise!"
he cried in a terrible voice.
"And let me kill you, as you have killed my son!"
As he uttered these words, he gave a frightful yell. The merchant, quite as much terrified at the hideous face of the monster as at his words, answered him tremblingly.
"Alas, good sir, what can I have done to you to deserve death?"
"I shall kill you,"
repeated the genius,
"as you have killed my son."
"But," said the merchant, "how can I have killed your son? I do not know him, and I have never even seen him."
"When you arrived here, did you not sit down on the ground?"
asked the genius.
"And did you not take some dates from your wallet? And whilst eating them, did not you throw the stones about?"
"Yes," said the merchant, "I certainly did so."
"Then,"
said the genius,
"I tell you, you have killed my son, for whilst you were throwing about the stones, my son passed by, and one of them struck him in the eye and killed him. So I shall kill you."
"Oh, sir, forgive me,"
cried the merchant.
"I will have no mercy on you,"
answered the genius.
"But I killed your son quite unintentionally, so I implore you to spare my life."
"No,"
said the genius.
"I shall kill you as you killed my son."
And so saying, he seized the merchant by the arm, threw him on the ground, and lifted his saber to cut off his head. The merchant, protesting his innocence, bewailed his wife and children and tried pitifully to avert his fate. The genius, with his raised scimitar, waited till he had finished, but was not in the least touched.
Scheherazade, at this point, seeing that it was day, and knowing that the Sultan always rose very early to attend the council, stopped speaking.
"Indeed, sister," said Dinarzad, "this is a wonderful story."
"The rest is still more wonderful," replied Scheherazade. "And you would say so if the Sultan would allow me to live another day, and would give me leave to tell it to you the next night."
Shahryar, who had been listening to Scheherazade with pleasure, said to himself,
"I will wait till tomorrow. I can always have her killed when I have heard the end of her story."
All this time, the Grand Vizier was in a terrible state of anxiety, but he was much delighted when he saw the Sultan enter the council chamber without giving the terrible command that he was expecting. The next morning, before the day broke, Dinarzade said to her sister,
"Dear sister, if you are awake, I pray you to go on with your story."
The Sultan did not wait for Scheherazade to ask his leave.
"Finish," said he, "the story of the genius and the merchant. I am curious to hear the end."
So Scheherazade went on with the story. This happened every morning. The Sultana told a story, and the Sultan let her live to finish it.
When the merchant saw that the genius was determined to cut off his head, he said,
"One more word, I entreat you. Grant me a little delay, just a short time to go home, and bid my wife and children farewell, and to make my will. When I have done this, I will come back here, and you shall kill me."
"But,"
said the genius,
If I grant you the delay you ask, I am afraid that you will not come back.
I give you my word of honor, answered the merchant, that I will come back without fail.
How long do you require?
Asked the genius. I ask for a year's grace, replied the merchant. I promise you that tomorrow, 12th month, I shall be waiting under these trees to give myself up to you. On this, the genius left him near the fountain and disappeared. The merchant, having recovered from his fright, mounted his horse and went on his road. When he arrived home, his wife and children received him with the greatest joy. But instead of embracing them, he began to weep so bitterly that they soon guessed that something terrible was the matter. "Tell us, I pray you," said his wife. "What has happened?"
"Alas," answered her husband, "I have only a year to live."
Then he told them what had passed between him and the genius, and how he had given his word to return at the end of a year to be killed. When they heard this sad news, they were in despair and wept much. The next day the merchant began to settle his affairs, and first of all to pay his debts. He gave presents to his friends and large alms to the poor. He set his slaves at liberty and provided for his wife and children. The year soon passed away, and he was obliged to depart. When he tried to say goodbye, he was quite overcome with grief, and with difficulty tore himself away. At length, he reached the place where he had first seen the genius on the very day that he had appointed. He dismounted and sat down at the edge of the fountain, where he awaited the genius in terrible suspense. Whilst he was thus waiting, an old man leading a hind came towards him. They greeted one another, and then the old man said to him,
"May I ask, brother, what brought you to this desert place, where there are so many evil genii about? To see these beautiful trees, one would imagine it was inhabited. But it is a dangerous place to stop long in."
The merchant told the old man why he was obliged to come there. He listened in astonishment.
"This is a most marvelous affair. I should like to be a witness of your interview with the genius."
So saying, he sat down by the merchant. While they were talking, another old man came up, followed by two black dogs. He greeted them and asked what they were doing in this place. The old man who was leading the hind told him the adventure of the merchant and the genius. The second old man had not sooner heard the story than he, too, decided to stay there to see what would happen. He sat down by the others and was talking when a third old man arrived. He asked why the merchant who was with them looked so sad. They told him the story, and he also resolved to see what would pass between the genius and the merchant, so waited with the rest. They soon saw in the distance a thick smoke, like a cloud of dust. This smoke came nearer and nearer, and then, all at once, it vanished, and they saw the genius, who, without speaking to them, approached the merchant, sword in hand, and, taking him by the arm, said,
"Get up! And let me kill you as you killed my son."
The merchant and the three old men began to weep and groan. Then the old man leading the hind threw himself at the monster's feet and said,
"Oh, prince of the genii, I beg of you to stay your fury and to listen to me. I am going to tell you my story and that of the hind I have with me. And if you find it more marvelous than that of the merchant whom you are about to kill, I hope that you will do away with a third part of his punishment."
The genius considered some time, and then he said,
"Very well, I agree to this."
The Story of the First Old Man and of the Hind.
"I am now going to begin my story," said the old man, "so please attend. This hind that you see with me is my wife. We have no children of our own, therefore I adopted the son of a favorite slave, and determined to make him my heir.
My wife, however, took a great dislike to both mother and child, which she concealed from me till too late. When my adopted son was about 10 years old, I was obliged to go on a journey. Before I went, I entrusted my wife's keeping both the mother and child, and begged her to take care of them during my absence, which lasted a whole year. During this time, she studied magic in order to carry out her wicked scheme. When she had learnt enough, she took my son into a distant place and changed him into a calf. Then she gave him to my steward and told him to look after a calf she had bought. She also changed the slave into a cow, which she sent to my steward. When I returned, I inquired after my slave and the child. "Your slave is dead," she said. "And as for your son, I have not seen him for 2 months, and I do not know where he is." I was grieved to hear of my slave's death, but as my son had only disappeared, I thought I should soon find him. 8 months, however, passed, and still no tidings of him. Then the feast of Bairam came. To celebrate it, I ordered my steward to bring me a very fat cow to sacrifice. He did so. The cow that he brought was my unfortunate slave. I bound her, but just as I was about to kill her, she began to low most piteously, and I saw that her eyes were streaming with tears. It seemed to me most extraordinary, and, feeling a movement of pity, I ordered the steward to lead her away and bring another. My wife, who was present, scoffed at my compassion, which made her malice of no avail.
"What are you doing?" she cried. "Kill this cow. It is the best we have to sacrifice."
To please her, I tried again, but again the animal's lows and tears disarmed me. "Take her away," I said to the steward, "and kill her. I cannot." The steward killed her, but on skinning her found that she was nothing but bones, although she appeared so fat. I was vexed. "Keep her for yourself," I said to the steward, "and if you have a fat calf, bring that in her stead." In a short time he brought a very fat calf, which, although I did not know it, was my son. It tried hard to break its cord and come to me. It threw itself at my feet, with its head on the ground, as if it wished to excite my pity and to beg me not to take away its life. I was even more surprised and touched at this action than I had been at the tears of the cow. "Go," I said to the steward, "take back this calf, take great care of it, and bring me another in its place instantly." As soon as my wife heard me speak this, she at once cried out,
"What are you doing, husband? Do not sacrifice any calf but this."
"Wife," I answered, "I will not sacrifice this calf." And in spite of all her remonstrances, I remained firm. I had another calf killed. This one was led away. The next day the steward asked to speak to me in private.
"I have come," he said, "to tell you some news which I think you will like to hear. I have a daughter who knows magic. Yesterday, when I was leading back the calf which you refused to sacrifice, I noticed that she smiled, and then directly afterwards began to cry. I asked her why she did so.
'Father,'
she answered,
'this calf is the son of our master. I smiled with joy at seeing him still alive, and I weep to think of his mother, who was sacrificed yesterday as a cow. These changes have been wrought by our master's wife, who hated the mother and son.'"
"At these words, oh genius," continued the old man, "I leave you to imagine my astonishment. I went immediately with the steward to speak with his daughter myself. First of all, I went to the stable to see my son, and he replied in his dumb way to all my caresses. When the steward's daughter came, I asked her if she could change my son back to his proper shape.
'Yes, I can,' she replied, 'on 2 conditions. One is that you will give him to me for a husband, and the other is that you will let me punish the woman who changed him into a calf.'
To the first condition, I answered, 'I agree with all my heart, and I will give you an ample dowry. To the second, I also agree, only beg you to spare her life.'
'That I will do,' she replied. 'I will treat her as she treated your son.
Then she took a vessel of water and pronounced over it some words I did not understand. Then, on throwing the water over him, he became immediately a young man once more. "My son! My dear son!" I exclaimed, kissing him in a transport of joy. "This kind maiden has rescued you from a terrible enchantment, and I am sure that out of gratitude you will marry her." He consented joyfully, but before they were married the young girl changed my wife into a hind, and it is she whom you see before you. I wished her to have this form rather than a stranger one so that we could see her in the family without repugnance. Since then my son has become a widower and has gone traveling. I am now going in search of him, and not wishing to confide my wife to the care of other people, I am taking her with me. Is this not a most marvelous tale?
It is indeed, said the genius, and because of it I grant to you the third part of the punishment of this merchant.
When the first old man had finished his story, the second, who was leading the two black dogs, said to the genius,
I am going to tell you what happened to me, and I am sure that you will find my story even more astonishing than the one to which you have just been listening. But when I have related it, will you grant me also the third part of the merchant's punishment?
Yes, replied the genius, provided that your story surpasses that of the hind.
With this agreement, the second old man began in this way. The Story of the Second Old Man and of the Two Black Dogs.
Great prince of the genii, you must know that we are three brothers, these two black dogs and myself. Our father died, leaving us each 1,000 sequins. With this sum, we all three took up the same profession and became merchants. A short time after we had opened our shops, my eldest brother, one of these two dogs, resolved to travel in foreign countries for the sake of merchandise. With this intention, he sold all he had and bought merchandise suitable to the voyages he was about to make. He set out and was away a whole year. At the end of this time, a beggar came to my shop. "Good day," I said.
"Good day,"
he answered.
"Is it possible that you do not recognize me?"
Then I looked at him closely and saw he was my brother. I made him come into my house and asked him how he had fared in his enterprise.
"Do not question me,"
he replied.
"Seeing me, you see all I have. It would but renew my trouble to tell of all the misfortunes that have befallen me in a year and have brought me to this state."
I shut up my shop, paid him every attention, taking him to the bath, giving him my most beautiful robes. I examined my accounts and found that I had doubled my capital. That is, that I now possessed 2,000 sequins. I gave my brother half, saying, "Now, brother, you can forget your losses." He accepted them with joy, and we lived together as we had before. Some time afterwards, my second brother wished also to sell his business and travel. My eldest brother and I did all we could to dissuade him, but it was of no use. He joined a caravan and set out. He came back at the end of a year in the same state as his elder brother. I took care of him, and as I had 1,000 sequins to spare, I gave them to him, and he reopened his shop. One day my two brothers came to me to propose we should make a journey and trade. At first I refused to go. "You traveled," I said, "and what did you gain?" But they came to me repeatedly, and after having held out for 5 years, I at last gave way. But when they had made their preparation, and they began to buy the merchandise we needed, they found they had spent every piece of the 1,000 sequins I had given them. I did not reproach them. I divided my 6,000 sequins with them, giving 1,000 to each and keeping one for myself, and the other 3 I buried in a corner of my house. We bought merchandise, loaded a vessel with it, and set forth with a favorable wind.
After 2 months sailing, we arrived at a seaport, where we disembarked and did a great trade. Then we bought the merchandise of the country, and were just going to sail once more, when I was stopped on the shore by a beautiful, though very poorly dressed, woman. She came up to me, kissed my hand, and implored me to marry her and take her on board. At first I refused, but she begged so hard and promised to be such a good wife to me that at last I consented. I got her some beautiful dresses, and after having married her, we embarked and set sail. During the voyage, I discovered so many good qualities in my wife that I began to love her more and more. But my brothers began to be jealous of my prosperity and set to work to plot against my life. One night, when we were sleeping, they threw my wife and myself into the sea. My wife, however, was a fairy, and so she did not let me drown, but transported me to an island. When the day dawned, she said to me, "When I saw you on the seashore, I took a great fancy to you, and wished to try your good nature, so I presented myself in the disguise you saw. Now I have rewarded you by saving your life, but I am very angry with your brothers, and I shall not rest till I have taken their lives." I thanked the fairy for all that she had done for me, but I begged her not to kill my brothers. I appeased her wrath, and in a moment she transported me from the island where we were to the roof of my house, and she disappeared a moment afterwards. I went down and opened the door and dug up the 3,000 sequins which I had buried. I went to the place where my shop was, opened it, and received from my fellow merchants congratulations on my return. When I went home, I saw 2 black dogs who came to me with sorrowful faces. I was much astonished, but the fairy, who reappeared, said to me, "Do not be surprised to see these dogs. They are your 2 brothers. I have condemned them to remain for 10 years in these shapes." Then, having told me where I could hear news of her, she vanished. The 10 years are nearly past, and I am on the road to find her. As in passing, I met this merchant and the old man with the hind. I stayed with them. This is my history, O Prince of the Genii. Do you not think it is a most marvelous one?
"Yes, indeed," replied the genius, "and I will give up to you the 3rd of the merchant's punishment."
Then the 3rd old man made the genius the same request as the other 2 had done, and the genius promised him the last 3rd of the merchant's punishment if his story surpassed both the others. So he told his story to the genius, but I cannot tell you what it was, as I do not know. But I do know that it was even more marvelous than either of the others, so that the genius was astonished, and said to the 3rd old man,
"I will give up to you the 3rd part of the merchant's punishment. He ought to thank all 3 of you for having interested yourselves in his favor. But for you, he would be here no longer."
So saying, he disappeared, to the great joy of the company. The merchant did not fail to thank his friends, and then each went on his way. The merchant returned to his wife and children, and passed the rest of his days happily with them.
"But, sire," added Scheherazade, "however beautiful are the stories I have just told you, they cannot compare with the story of the fishermen."
The Story of the Fishermen.
Sire, there was once upon a time a fisherman so old and so poor that he could scarcely manage to support his wife and 3 children. He went every day to fish very early, and each day he made a rule not to throw his nets more than 4 times. He started out one morning by moonlight and came to the seashore. He undressed and threw his nets, and as he was drawing them towards the bank, he felt a great weight. He thought he had caught a large fish, and he felt very pleased. But a moment afterwards, seeing that instead of a fish, he only had in his nets the carcass of an ass, he was much disappointed. vexed with having such a bad haul, when he had mended his nets, which the carcass of the ass had broken in several places, he threw them a second time. In drawing them in, he again felt a great weight, so that he thought they were full of fish. But he only found a large basket full of rubbish. He was much annoyed.
"Oh, fortune!" he cried. "Do not trifle thus with me, a poor fisherman who can hardly support his family."
So saying, he threw away the rubbish, and after having washed his nets clean of the dirt, he threw them for the third time. But he only drew in stones, shells, and mud. He was almost in despair. Then he threw his nets for the fourth time. When he thought he had a fish, he drew them in with a great deal of trouble. There was no fish, however, but he found a yellow pot, which by its weight seemed full of something, and he noticed that it was fastened and sealed with lead, with the impression of a seal. He was delighted.
"I will sell it to the founder," he said. "With the money I shall get for it, I shall buy a measure of wheat."
He examined the jar on all sides. He shook it to see if it would rattle, but he heard nothing, and so, judging from the impression of the seal and the lid, he thought there must be something precious inside. To find out, he took his knife, and with a little trouble, he opened it. He turned it upside down, but nothing came out, which surprised him very much. He set it in front of him, and whilst he was looking at it attentively, such a thick smoke came out that he had to step back a pace or two. This smoke rose up to the clouds, and stretching over the sea and the shore, formed a thick mist, which caused the fisherman much astonishment. When all the smoke was out of the jar, it gathered itself together, and became a thick mass, in which appeared a genius, twice as large as the largest giant. When he saw such a terrible-looking monster, the fisherman would like to have run away, but he trembled so with fright that he could not move a step.
"Great king of the genii," cried the monster, "I will never again disobey you."
At these words, the fisherman took courage.
"What is this you are saying, great genius? Tell me your history, and how you came to be shut up in that vase."
At this, the genius looked at the fisherman haughtily.
"Speak to me more civilly," he said, "before I kill you."
"Alas, why should you kill me?" cried the fisherman. "I have just freed you. Have you already forgotten that?"
"No,"
answered the genius.
"But that will not prevent me from killing you, and I am only going to grant you one favor, and that is to choose the manner of your death."
"But what have I done to you?" asked the fisherman.
"I cannot treat you in any other way," said the genius. "And if you would know why, listen to my story. I rebelled against the king of the genii. To punish me, he shut me up in this vase of copper, and he put on the leaden cover his seal, which is enchantment enough to prevent my coming out. Then he had the vase thrown into the sea. During the first period of my captivity, I vowed that if anyone should free me before 100 years were passed, I would make him rich, even after his death. But that century passed, and no one freed me. In the second century, I vowed that I would give all the treasures in the world to my deliverer. But he never came. In the third, I promised to make him a king, to be always near him, and to grant him 3 wishes every day. But that century passed away as the other two had done, and I remained in the same plight. At last I grew angry at being captive for so long, and I vowed that if anyone would release me, I would kill him at once, and would only allow him to choose in what manner he should die. So you see, as you have freed me today, choose in what way you will die."
The fisherman was very unhappy. "What an unlucky man I am to have freed you. I implore you to spare my life."
"I have told you," said the genius, that it is impossible. Choose quickly. You are wasting time.
The fisherman began to devise a plot.
Since I must die,
he said,
before I choose the manner of my death, I conjure you, on your honor, to tell me if you really were in that vase.
Yes, I was,
answered the genius.
I really cannot believe it, said the fisherman. That vase could not contain one of your feet even, and how could your whole body go in? I cannot believe it unless I see you do the thing.
Then the genius began to change himself into smoke, which, as before, spread over the sea and the shore, and which, then collecting itself together, began to go back into the vase slowly and evenly till there was nothing left outside. Then a voice came from the vase, which said to the fisherman,
Well, unbelieving fisherman, here I am in the vase. Do you believe me now?
The fisherman, instead of answering, took the lid of lead and shut it down quickly on the vase.
Now, O genius,
he cried,
ask pardon of me, and choose by what death you will die. But no, it will be better if I throw you into the sea whence I drew you out, and I will build a house on the shore to warn fishermen who come to cast their nets here against fishing up such a wicked genius as you are, who vows to kill the man who frees you.
At these words, the genius did all he could to get out, but he could not, because of the enchantment on the lid. Then he tried to get out by cunning.
If you will take off the cover,
he said,
I will repay you.
No, answered the fisherman. If I trust myself to you, I am afraid you will treat me as a certain Greek king treated the physician Douban. Listen, and I will tell you.
The Story of the Greek King and the Physician Douban. In the country of Zuman, in Persia, there lived a Greek king. This king was a leper, and all his doctors had been unable to cure him, when a very clever physician, named Douban, came to his court. He was very learned in all languages and knew a great deal about herbs and medicines. As soon as he was told of the king's illness, he put on his best robe and presented himself before the king.
Sire, said he, I know that no physician has been able to cure your majesty, but if you will follow my instructions, I will promise to cure you without any medicines or outward application.
The king listened to this proposal.
If you are clever enough to do this, he said, I promise to make you and your descendants rich forever.
The physician went to his house and made a polo club, the handle of which he hollowed out, and put in it the drug he wished to use. Then he made a ball, and with these things he went the next day to the king. He told him that he wished him to play at polo. Accordingly, the king mounted his horse and went into the place where he played. There the physician approached him with the bat he had made, saying,
Take this, sire, and strike the ball till you feel your hand and whole body in a glow. When the remedy that is in the handle of the club is warmed by your hand, it will penetrate throughout your body. Then you must return to your palace, bathe, and go to sleep, and when you awake tomorrow morning, you will be cured.
The king took the club and urged his horse after the ball which he had thrown. He struck it, and then it was hit back by the courtiers who were playing with him. When he felt very hot, he stopped playing, and went back to the palace, went into the bath, and did all that the physician had said. The next day, when he arose, he found, to his great joy and astonishment, that he was completely cured. When he entered his audience chamber, all his courtiers, who were eager to see if the wonderful cure had been effected, were overwhelmed with joy. The physician Douban entered the hall and bowed low to the ground. The king, seeing him, called him, made him sit by his side, and showed him every mark of honor. That evening he gave him a long and rich robe of state, and presented him with 2,000 sequins. The following day he continued to load him with favors. Now the king had a grand vizier who was avaricious and envious, and a very bad man. He grew extremely jealous of the physician, and determined to bring about his ruin. In order to do this, he asked to speak in private with the king, saying that he had a most important communication to make.
"What is it?" asked the king.
"Sire," answered the Grand Vizier, "it is most dangerous for a monarch to confide in a man whose faithfulness is not proved. You do not know that this physician is not a traitor come here to assassinate you."
"I am sure," said the king, "that this man is the most faithful and virtuous of men. If he wished to take my life, why did he cure me?"
"Cease to speak against him. I see what it is. You are jealous of him."
"But do not think that I can be turned against him. I remember well what a vizier said to King Sindbad, his master, to prevent him from putting the prince, his son, to death."
What the Greek king said excited the vizier's curiosity, and he said to him,
"Sire, I beg your majesty to have the condescension to tell me what the vizier said to King Sindbad."
"This vizier," he replied, "told King Sindbad that one ought not believe everything that a mother-in-law says, and told him this story."
The Story of the Husband and the Parrot. A good man had a beautiful wife, whom he loved passionately, and never left if possible. One day, when he was obliged by important business to go away from her, he went to a place where all kinds of birds are sold and bought a parrot. This parrot not only spoke well, but it had the gift of telling all that had been done before it. He brought it home in a cage, and asked his wife to put it in her room, and take great care of it while he was away. Then he departed. On his return, he asked the parrot what had happened during his absence, and the parrot told him some things which made him scold his wife. She thought that one of her slaves must have been telling tales of her, but they told her it was the parrot, and she resolved to revenge herself on him. When her husband next went away for one day, she told one slave to turn under the bird's cage a handmill, another to throw water down from above the cage, and a third to take a mirror and turn it in front of its eyes, from left to right, by the light of a candle. The slaves did this for part of the night, and did it very well. The next day, when the husband came back, he asked the parrot what he had seen. The bird replied,
"My good master, the lightning, thunder, and rain disturbed me so much all night long that I cannot tell you what I have suffered."
The husband, who knew that it had neither rained nor thundered in the night, was convinced that the parrot was not speaking the truth, so he took him out of the cage and threw him so roughly on the ground that he killed him. Nevertheless, he was sorry afterwards, for he found that the parrot had spoken the truth. "When the Greek king," said the fisherman to the genius, "had finished the story of the parrot, he added to the vizier,
'And so, vizier, I shall not listen to you, and I shall take care of the physician, in case I repent, as the husband did when he had killed the parrot.'"
But the vizier was determined.
"Sire," he replied, "the death of the parrot was nothing, but when it is a question of the life of a king, it is better to sacrifice the innocent than save the guilty. It is no uncertain thing, however. The physician Duban wishes to assassinate you. My zeal prompts me to disclose this to your majesty. If I am wrong, I deserve to be punished as a vizier was once punished."
"What had the vizier done," said the Greek king, "to merit the punishment?"
"I will tell your majesty, if you will do me the honor to listen," answered the vizier.
The Story of the Vizier Who Was Punished. There was once upon a time a king who had a son who was very fond of hunting. He often allowed him to indulge in this pastime, but he had ordered his grand vizier always to go with him, and never to lose sight of him. One day the huntsman roused the stag, and the prince, thinking that the vizier was behind, gave chase, and rode so hard that he found himself alone. He stopped, and having lost sight of it, he turned to rejoin the vizier, who had not been careful enough to follow him. But he lost his way. Whilst he was trying to find it, he saw on the side of the road a beautiful lady, who was crying bitterly. He drew his horse's rein and asked her who she was and what she was doing in this place, and if she needed help.
"I am the daughter of an Indian king," she answered, "and whilst riding in the country, I fell asleep and tumbled off. My horse has run away, and I do not know what has become of him."
The young prince had pity on her and offered to take her behind him, which he did. As they passed by a ruined building, the lady dismounted and went in. The prince also dismounted and followed her. To his great surprise, he heard her saying to someone inside,
"Rejoice, my children, I am bringing you a very nice fat youth."
And other voices replied,
"Where is he, mama?
That we may eat him at once,
as we are very hungry."
The prince at once saw the danger he was in. He now knew that the lady who said she was the daughter of an Indian king was an ogress, who lived in desolate places, and who by a thousand wiles surprised and devoured passers-by. He was terrified, and threw himself on his horse. The pretended princess appeared at this moment, and seeing that she had lost her prey, she said to him,
"Do not be afraid. What do you want?"
"I am lost," he answered, "and I am looking for the road."
"Keep straight on," said the ogress, "and you will find it."
The prince could hardly believe his ears and rode off as hard as he could. He found his way and arrived safe and sound at his father's house, where he told him of the danger he had run because of the Grand Vizier's carelessness. The king was very angry and had him strangled immediately.
"Sire," went on the vizier to the Greek king, "to return to the physician Duban. If you do not take care, you will repent of having trusted him. Who knows that this remedy, with which he has cured you, may not in time have a bad effect on you?"
The Greek king was naturally very weak, and did not perceive the wicked intention of his vizier, nor was he firm enough to keep to his first resolution.
"Well, vizier," he said, "you are right. Perhaps he did come to take my life. He might do it by the mere smell of one of his drugs. I must see what can be done. The best means, sire, to put your life in security, is to send for him at once, and to cut off his head directly he comes," said the vizier.
"I really think," replied the king, "that will be the best way."
He then ordered one of his ministers to fetch the physician, who came at once.
"I have had you sent for," said the king, "in order to free myself from you by taking your life."
The physician was beyond measure astonished when he heard he was to die.
"What crimes have I committed, your majesty?"
"I have learnt," replied the king, "that you are a spy, and intend to kill me. But I will be first, and kill you. Strike," he added to an executioner who was by, "and rid me of this assassin."
At this cruel order, the physician threw himself on his knees.
"Spare my life," he cried, "and yours will be spared."
The fisherman stopped here to say to the genius, "You see what passed between the Greek king and the physician has just passed between us two. The Greek king," he went on, "had no mercy on him, and the executioner bound his eyes." All those present begged for his life, but in vain. The physician, on his knees and bound, said to the king,
"At least let me put my affairs in order, and leave my books to persons who will make good use of them. There is one which I should like to present to your majesty. It is very precious, and ought to be kept carefully in your treasury. It contains many curious things, the chief being that when you cut off my head, if your majesty will turn to the sixth leaf and read the third line of the left-hand page, my head will answer all the questions you like to ask it."
The king, eager to see such a wonderful thing, put off his execution to the next day, and sent him under a strong guard to his house. There the physician put his affairs in order, and the next day there was a great crowd assembled in the hall to see his death, and the doings after it. The physician went up to the foot of the throne with a large book in his hand. He carried a basin, on which he spread the covering of the book, and presenting it to the king, said,
"Sire, take this book, and when my head is cut off, let it be placed in the basin on the covering of this book. As soon as it is there, the blood will cease to flow,
Then open the book, and my head will answer your questions. But, sire, I implore your mercy, for I am innocent.
Your prayers are useless, and if it were only to hear your head speak when you are dead, you should die.
So saying, he took the book from the physician's hands and ordered the executioner to do his duty. The head was so cleverly cut off that it fell into the basin, and directly the blood ceased to flow. Then, to the great astonishment of the king, the eyes opened, and the head said,
"Your Majesty, open the book."
The king did so, and finding that the first leaf stuck against the second, he put his finger in his mouth to turn it more easily. He did the same thing till he reached the sixth page, and not seeing any writing on it,
"Physician,"
he said,
"there is no writing." "Turn over a few more pages,"
answered the head. The king went on turning, still putting his finger in his mouth, till the poison, in which each page was dipped, took effect. His sight failed him, and he fell at the foot of his throne. When the physician's head saw that the poison had taken effect, and that the king had only a few more minutes to live,
"Tyrant," it cried, "see how cruelty and injustice are punished."
Scarcely had it uttered these words than the king died, and the head lost also the little life that had remained in it. That is the end of the story of the Greek king, and now let us return to the fisherman and the genius.
"If the Greek king," said the fisherman, "had spared the physician, he would not have thus died. The same thing applies to you. Now I am going to throw you into the sea."
"My friend," said the genius, "do not do such a cruel thing. Do not treat me as Ima treated Ateka."
"What did Ima do to Ateka?" asked the fisherman.
"Do you think I can tell you?